Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and get an update on the Japanese nuclear disaster that appears to be much worse than Japanese officials are admitting. Alan Vanko, the Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager at the Union of Concerned Scientists, joined us. Then we'll look into unrest in Syria, sparked by government brutality that could mirror the evolution of other recent revolutions in the Middle East and lead to regime change, ending one of the most entrenched and ossified regimes in the Middle East. James Galvin, a specialist on Syria, joins us. Then we'll talk with the writer and director of Miral, a movie that brings a new perspective to an old and politically contentious story. Rula Jibril and Julian Schnabel join us to talk about their brave new film based on Jibril's autobiographical novel that tells her story of growing up as an Israeli-Palestinian in a divided land where there is little agreement on anything, including history. Let me now turn to the situation in Japan. Joining us is Alan Vanko, Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Previously, she was Director of Communications and Government Affairs for the North American Electric Reliability Council and also directed policy analysis for Allegheny Energy and the Edison Electric Institute. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Alan Vanko.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And clearly, one would think, and I've spoken to a number of specialists, including Victor Galinsky and others who have a background, including the designer of the boiling water Mark I reactor, Dale Bridenbaugh, who quit GA back in the 1970s. Would you agree that this accident was avoidable in as much as had the power failure been prevented by bunkering the emergency generators with a proper berm to defend against this kind of wave action from tsunamis, which there's a history of in that area? Do you think this could have been avoided?
That is absolutely unclear to me at this point. You had a record-making earthquake followed by a large tsunami and then the failure of the pumps. There's any number of things that could have failed that might have led to this. So I think until the full examination is done of this situation, which of course will take several years, I wouldn't want to predict exactly how it and whether it could have been prevented.
Well, people survive because they move to the second floor of buildings with two floors. That the question is why wasn't the backup generators, you know, either protected by a berm and above a reasonable expectation of a high watermark for a tsunami?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm sure the designer of the plant could tell you better why that is, but I think it's also important to point out that the spent fuel pools were also elevated several feet above the several stories above the ground level, and that they're still experiencing problems. So yes, there should have been protections in place to keep the fuel supply for the pumps from running out. But again, given the severity of the damage, it's not sure that every single one of these incidents could have been prevented. There's no one who can say that, for example, the berms wouldn't have been breached due to the earthquake.
Sure. Well, the problem with this, Alan Vanko, is that the Japanese authorities are not being particularly forthcoming. There seems to be a divide between the government itself, and Japan's never had a very strong chief executive. They tend to, the ruling party tends to be led by token frontmen with the powerful players in the back rooms. And TEPCO, the Tokyo Power Company, keeps reversing what they're saying all the time. Does anybody have a good handle on this information, and do we know exactly what's going on?
Well, at this point in time, it is unclear to us. When I say us, I mean people at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who are, of course, getting information from TEPCO and the Japanese government and other people on the ground in Japan, similar to many other folks who are trying to figure out what's going on. It's not clear to us that TEPCO or the government of Japan actually have all the information they need to respond to this crisis, never mind tell the rest of the world exactly what is going on.
But we know, for example, from the two workers that were exposed to high levels of radiations, thousands times more than the threshold, that's at unit number 3, which indicates that kind of amount of radiation most people think is due to a breached core. Do we know how many of these reactors have the cores have been breached?
I don't know that we know anything for sure, as I've said. Obviously, the one thing we do know is they do not have adequate worker safety protections in place. That's the first thing that the exposure of the two workers tells me. I do want to draw your attention to something that the Union of Concerned Scientists just posted on its blog on this topic. And what it is a picture of the control room that they're claiming to have restored power to in Fukushima Unit number 2. And if you look at the control room, there's clearly lights, but all of gauges, there's lights that illuminate the control room, but all of the gauges and lights and computer screens that would be needed to monitor the condition of the plant and its equipment are completely blank. They are non-functional. What this picture tells us is that there is no telemetry at the site other than what might be being carried around by the workers in the plant. But the actual control room that not only somebody monitoring a working nuclear plant but also a malfunctioning nuclear plant would need to have to know what's going on, those screens are blank, those lights are off, the gauges are flat. So that leads us to question whether they have any meaningful information whatsoever about their own plant. And if that's the case, then that would certainly help to explain why we're not getting much better information outside of it.
So nobody really knows about how much water has been contaminated. There are stories of hundreds of tons of water that have been, because there's been a lot of seawater poured, and we know that's very corrosive to metal. The U.S. is barging in a bunch of fresh water, which they're hoping to have pumped to cool these cores. It'll take years, perhaps, to cool them. We don't know the full extent of the contamination. Apparently, they've backtracked that it was millions of times above the threshold, and now they're backing away from that. But we don't know how much contaminated water is and what they're going to do with it and where that water is.
No, I mean, it's difficult to make sense of any of the data being reported from the various parties regarding dose rates, contamination levels within the plant, outside of the plant, miles away. There doesn't seem to be any consistent reporting framework so that the public, whether they're experts or not, can assess what kind of radiation is being released from the plant, whether it's in the air or in the water, for that matter.
I take it the U.S. has a drone over there, but is there any understanding of I mean, are we entirely relying on the Japanese, or is there another way, since they seem to either be confused or covering up things? Where are we going to find out? This is a global problem, surely, given the potential for the contamination spreading around the world.
Well, it's clearly a global problem in the long run, but I think in the immediate frame, we're dealing with a crisis on the ground in Japan, and they need to get a handle on what they want to do to protect their public, both immediately, within the immediate vicinity, beyond the 12-mile radius they've already evacuated, and also what the impacts are going to be on the rest of Japan. Of course, everybody else needs to be concerned about the release of radiation and where it could ultimately end up. But right now, the most immediate crisis and emergency is around the reactors and to the people of Japan. I don't want to minimize the potential for further contamination and transportation of these radioactive materials beyond Japan, but right now those are the people who are in the greatest danger and have to be helped right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ellen Vanko.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Ellen Vanko, Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists. We'll take a brief break and we'll be back talking about whether the Syrian regime is falling apart. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by James Gelvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of the Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his forthcoming book is From Modernization to Globalization, the United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Gelvin.
Thank you for inviting me.
And it seems to me that that this most ossified and entrenched regime, which always seemed impregnable, back in the early 1980s, the father of the current dictator, who's the accidental son, by the way, the ophthalmologist who's now inherited a dictatorship, he killed thousands of people in Hama. And they've had a state of emergency for over 30 years. As a Syrian specialist, are you surprised at the cracks in the regime happening so fast and furious?
Absolutely. When events began to unfold in Tunisia and then in Egypt, there were articles written in a variety of publications by other Syrian specialists about why not Syria. And there were a whole bunch of reasons given why the Syrian regime was not going to suffer the same consequences as the Tunisian regime or the Egyptian regime. In part, people said, well, Bashar al-Assad has this myth going for him that he is a reformist son of Hafez al-Assad, but he's being held back by those people around him. Just give him a chance. And we see, actually, that these prognostications, like most of them, about what's been going on in the region, turned out not to be true. As of now, we have no idea how significant the cracks in the regime actually are, the cracks in governance of Syria actually are. But we can see that our ideas, the optimistic ideas that Bashar al-Assad will just hold on, weather the storm, are not true.
And he is, of course, has held on to power by in part because of the intractable opposition to Israel, and of course Israel is being blamed and the Mossad are being blamed for these demonstrations. I take it, though, that the young people and the people who've been outraged by the fact that it started with a bunch of teenagers spraying freedom on the walls and has led to shooting people wholesale in the streets, this is really seems to be about Syrians wanting to be free.
It absolutely is. In terms of your previous statements, though, what's very interesting is that when the Interior Minister got up yesterday and gave a speech, it was not the Israelis that were blamed, it was the Palestinians that were blamed, Palestinians from the camps around Latakia for fomenting difficulties. And what's interesting is that the government is playing the card that they play the best, which is a sectarian card. We are necessary in order to prevent the sectarian breakup of Syria. And this is the same sort of card that Mubarak played and that Saleh is now playing in Yemen as well, that without us, it's going to be either the Islamists or we're going to descend into some sort of sectarian rioting or something along those lines.
So James Gelvin, history professor at UCLA specializing in Syria, a lot of our analysts are saying that this is going to create problems if Syria collapse into chaos. This will create problems both for the Middle East peace agreement, about which there is none, so I don't know why that's a problem, and for the U.S. It could be both an opportunity in terms of being a blow to Iran, but it also could be a problem for Israel.
Well, you're absolutely correct in what you say about the peace process, which is that it's dead in the water. There is no peace process going on right now. The regime in Syria would very much like to get the Golan Heights back. The Israelis, however, because of the nature of coalition governments in Israel, cannot negotiate on the basis of return of Golan. So nothing is going to happen on that front. There are two other aspects of it that I think are very important, one of which is that nobody benefits from the division of any of these states into mini-states, that is just pure chaos and a prescription for more problems that would emerge. The second thing is, though, that the question of Iran, the United States and Iran, and their battle for influence in the Middle East. Syria has tilted towards Iran since the 1980s. But there's a reason for that, which is not the sectarian reason. I mean, people usually say, okay, look, the Syrian government is controlled by Alawites, which is a type of Shi'i sect, and so therefore would naturally tilt towards Iran. The problem is that Syria, in the geopolitical sense, has really nothing to offer except its ability to make trouble. And so what Syria very wildly did in the 1980s was to begin its tilt towards Iran it actually took the Iranian side in the Iran-Iraq War. And since that time, it's been able to parlay its ability to play one side against the other into maintaining a very, very important position in the geopolitical dynamic of the Middle East on the one hand, but coming at it from the strength of real weakness. I mean, Syria is not one of the 600-pound gorillas in the neighborhood. Egypt is one of the 600-pound gorillas. Iraq is one of the 600-pound gorillas. And even as weak as Saudi Arabia is, it's an extraordinarily wealthy state. So what Syria has been able to use is the Iran card to, for example, get the Saudis to underwrite its occupation of Lebanon for years and years.
So what is I know it has stultifying censorship and ubiquitous portraits of the son of the dictator and the Assad line family that create their own mythology, but they have a vast patronage system that drains the economy, and there's been no economic growth. But is the outside world filtering into the younger generation who have seen their brethren topple Mubarak's government and can now see Gaddafi's being routed by this reversal that's happening in Libya?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a new development, by the way. I mean, for years and years, of course, Syrians listened to Israeli radio as well as American Armed Forces radio as well as radio from abroad. They are now, of course, able to access more information sources from abroad. And with the rise of Al Jazeera and other outlets, what Syrians have been able to do is to been very closely follow events that have been taking place. I mean, on the night of the 25th or so, when things came to a head in Tahrir Square, January 25th, the Syrian government felt so threatened that it blocked out Al Jazeera. But you can't block out everything all the time. There is, for example, internet. There is a whole variety of sources outside of the government control that Syrians are capable of getting access to. And if you actually go on many of the websites, like, for example, the New York Times website, what you'll see is pictures that are shot from phones of demonstrations unfolding before your eyes in Latakia, in Hama, and other places as well.
In Hama, you just mentioned, James Galvin, of course, where Hafez al-Assad killed 25,000 Muslim Brotherhood. The conventional theory is that if the Assad family goes and the Alawites, the minority Alawites, lose their privileges and the patronage system cracks, that somehow the Muslim Brotherhood will take over. Now, that was often discussed in Egypt and widely refuted. However, as the dust settles in Egypt, it does look like the Muslim Brotherhood have made some kind of alliance with the military. So will the Muslim Brotherhood take over, do you think, if the Assads go?
The Muslim Brotherhood was virtually wiped out in Syria in the 1980s. One of the demands that's being made now, for example, by many of the protesters is for some sort of government accountability for the disappeared that took place during what might even be called a civil war that took place in the 1980s between the Brotherhood and the government. The Brotherhood was very well trounced. The importance, though, the thing that's important to look at in the Syrian case is that, unlike in the Egyptian case, where the Brotherhood was able to win 20% in elections, parliamentary elections, the Brotherhood only represents a very slender faction of the Syrian political spectrum. That most Syrians, for example, Syria is a much more secular society than Egypt is, that you have approximately 12% of the population that is not Sunni Muslim, but Muslim of other varieties, that you have 13% of the population or so that's Christian. There is a large group within Syria, even within the Sunni population, who look at a Islamic regime and shiver at the idea of it. So being able to play that card has been one of the ways in which the government has actually been able to maintain its hold over the popular opinion. But one thing that this brings up, you're bringing up Hama, is actually very interesting, because the two cities that actually have been the sites for the sudden, largest-scale rebellions that are breaking out now are Hama and Latakia. And those are very interesting symbolic centers for this to take place. Hama, as you mentioned, was bombarded by Hafez al-Assad after the Muslim Brotherhood attempted to take over, and 10 to 20,000 people were killed in the city itself. But Latakia is very, very interesting as well, because that's the home base of the Assad family. They come from the Alawite minority within the city itself. Most of the people in the government are affiliated with that city. And for both Hama and Latakia to now go out in the way that they have is very, very significant symbolically.
Well, clearly, if the Assads do fall, this will be a blow to Iran. If what you've just told us, James Galvin, is that this is a largely secular country, that that the only reason that they are in bed with this regime, this theocratic regime in Tehran, is because of the political calculations of the ruling family. If they go, that calculation goes too, right? Just in the last 30 seconds or so.
Or what we could do is flip that on its head and say, look, you know, it has nothing to do with theocracy, it has nothing to do with that. It's just a very, very smart strategic decision. So that if this family goes, whoever takes over, and at this point my money's on the military, but whoever takes over will also make the exact same decision.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, James Galvin.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. He is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria. And a new book is forthcoming, is Modernization and Globalization, the United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. We'll take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the filmmakers of this very, very powerful new film, Miral. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Rula Jabrail and Julian Schnabel, the writer and director of the new film, Miral. Rula Jabrail is a journalist who grew up in East Jerusalem and went to study in Italy, where she was a journalist for 12 years before moving to work at a television station in Cairo. Her autobiographical novel, Miral, is the basis of the film now out in theaters. Julian Schnabel is an artist and filmmaker. His works of art are displayed in museums worldwide, and his films, including Basquiat, The Before Night Falls, and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, have won critical acclaim and box office success. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rula Jabrail and Julian Schnabel.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And let me begin with you, Julian. It seems to me that it's very necessary, I think, the choice that you made to tell the history of this tortured relationship between the Israeli and Palestinians. You know, starting from the point of view of how the state of Israel was created, and the notion that in order to solve a European refugee problem, an Arab refugee problem was created. And it seems to me that that's necessary to attract a younger generation of an audience, because our education system is such that I don't think the history is accessible. So I'm kind of curious as to why there have been some complaints from reviewers about the history, because that is the history from which the characters emerge.
It is amazing, but I think that what I forget sometimes is that people really do come to this issue with preconceptions and essentially the Leon Uris narrative, subliminally, I think that people have kind of been blinded by the mere existence that this point of view would even exist, and let alone be talked about. Do you want to say something before I continue?
No, go ahead.
I didn't even realize it myself. I mean, because the Exodus narrative is something that, you know, I was weaned on. I was in the Rivoli Theater with my parents seeing Exodus on Broadway, and everybody stood up and put their hands on their hearts when they sang Hatikva. And it's wonderful to have a Jewish homeland in Israel, But the only way to have a Jewish homeland is for the homeland to be a home to everybody that lives there. And Jewish people can't have rights that Palestinian people don't have, or that Israeli Palestinians, Arab Israelis don't have. And that seems to be a mandate that exists in the United States of America, and supposedly in the state of Israel. So for me, a Jewish person who is an American Jewish person, whose mother was the president of Hadassah and is a devout, was a devout Zionist, and I also believe that the state of Israel needs to exist, but the only way we're going to exist is if we're benevolent, understanding, and give the Palestinians the same kind of respect and dignity that we expect as Jewish people.
And Rula Jabrel, you are an Israeli, right? You grew up in Haifa and in East Jerusalem.
I am Palestinian.
Well, that's
I was born from a Palestinian family, and I happen to my parents, both of them are Palestinians, and my sister was born in Jerusalem. She didn't have an Israeli passport, and I happened to be born in Haifa, and I had an Israeli passport. But my identity, my roots, and my family, my ethnic group is Palestinian. And, you know, it's incredible that when I hear you talking about why people here react to this, it's you know, this is the kind of taboo that you can see about certain issues, and one of them is the Palestinian issue. And we've been always denied to be part of the dialogue about what's going on in the Middle East. The only voices that you heard and you would hear in the media here is the Israeli voice. It's never happened in the history that you've heard or you read or you watched a narrative of a Palestinian person. That's why it's shocking for some people, but you cannot have any kind of solution for the Middle East if you don't include this point of view. That's why I think Julian is really courageous to bring this issue up and hold up a mirror to both sides, showing them what the reality is, and actually break this wall of silence.
Break the what?
The wall of silence.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't hear, okay.
And that is a peculiar kind of wall, Rula Jabrel, because it's sort of an enforcement of one version of reality. And for many decades I've conducted discussions between Israelis and Palestinians, and I also hosted the fellows that wrote the book about the Israel lobby, and tremendous contention, and had to deal with all kinds of anger. But from the Israeli side, the American Jewish side, it was basically, you either accept our reality, or you're an anti-Semite, and it's very offensive. And
it is very offensive, very disturbing. But you know what? I lived in a place where, in order to survive, I had to have an education. And the first thing that you learn, the first through the education, to become a critical thinker, and that brings you to actually criticize everything around you. Government, social behavior, political behavior, in a way, and that's supposed to be the essence of a democracy. When I lived in Italy, everybody was criticizing the government every day. But that's what made the government actually force the government to address certain issues like mafia, like corruption. In the United States, we every day see people criticizing, you know, on papers and as journalists, writers, or TV anchors, criticizing government. Does that make us become anti-American or anti-democratic? Actually, this dynamic helps not only the civil society, it helps, you know, the government to understand that what they are doing is affecting the result.
The effect on regular people.
Exactly, has effect on regular people. And Israel has to admit and has to understand that this is a dialogue that you have in a democracy. You cannot live in a democracy and behave like you are a regime. When you go to Cairo, and I went and I worked in Cairo, we were denied, and we were actually many times I was censored because I criticized the government or even raised questions about their behavior.
I think you're making a very valid point, and I feel in many ways that the film does a great educational service, not just in terms of the historical context it's established, out of which the characters and the story emerges, but also, I think, because there has been this kind of enforcement of one particular reality. And I've noticed over the years that the Europeans have drifted away from their original support for Israel. And unless this film and this debate is met with a certain level of equanimity and tolerance, you know, my problem with the dealing with this agony and trying to bridge these gaps by having these conferences over the years is that it's sort of descending into a kind of competition of victimhood.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I was talking yesterday, we give these Q&As after the movie, and I've thought about this a lot more certainly than I ever have before. And I know there's one thing that's true, and that is that every Israeli and every Palestinian have in common, and that is they all want their children to come home at the end of the day from school. And not one of them is guaranteed that their kid's going to come home, because whether it's a stray bullet from a soldier or a suicide bomber, something's going to get through that wall. You cannot make peace by building a wall around people. You have to open the hearts of people. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's really a cliche for a reason. We need to, if we don't accept that there's a dialogue rather than a monologue, unfortunately, our voices are going to get drowned out, because there's so many other people that are surrounding the state of Israel that also want democracy and that are getting it. There's a peaceful revolt that occurred in Egypt, in Tunisia, and it's spreading all over the Arab world, and it's all over the Mideast. And, you know, in 1987, when the Intifada started, this was the same thing. It was a peaceful demonstration. It started out being peaceful, and it became exacerbated into a war. When our movie stops, before our movie ends in 1994, there were no suicide bombers. There was no Hamas. And the settlements have been, again, the word exacerbated to an unholy number. And at first it was the notion of religious people thinking they needed to live in Hebron. Now it's just people finding cheaper rent. They have no political, they have no religious reason necessarily for doing this. They're just, according to Sharon's quote, grab everything, because whatever you don't grab is left for them. And unfortunately now, and it's all about demographics, and unfortunately now, in the movie it says that there was 22% of the land that they would accept. Well, there's not even 5% of the land left. So essentially, is it even possible to have a two-state solution? When the girl says, why can't we live in a democracy where everybody has the same rights, like in New York City, it sounds a little bit like out of the mouths of babes, but isn't that what everybody in the Mideast has been saying? And actually, something I find extremely disturbing is that, you know, I think Obama is a good man, and I voted for him, and I would vote for him again. But I'm so disappointed where, on one hand, he makes this great speech that really infused the Egyptian people with enthusiasm and a sense that they could have a democracy, and then he'll get up. And I can't believe that he actually means what he's saying when he vetoes the illegality of the new settlements. And it's a real tragedy that the Vogel family was killed. I mean, it's a tragedy, but that's no excuse for saying, okay, we're going to build another 500 settlements. I mean, that's not I can't think of a world leader or a statesman that would make that kind of declaration in regards that it seems totally irrational. And there's one other thing. Is yesterday, a man came to me before I even saw the movie, and he said, you know, he thinks that the Israelis are just trying to protect themselves because they keep getting rockets sent from Gaza. And, you know, I don't think he understands that if We just, if the Israeli government would take the settlers out of Hebron, there's 1,000 settlers in the middle of 160,000 Palestinians in Hebron that are terrorizing these people, that are terrorizing the Palestinian population to move out of their houses. I've seen, which made me ashamed, kids with payas and yarmulkes throwing rocks into a Palestinian person's house, throwing a rock and hitting a Palestinian person in the head while two soldiers stand by, do nothing, and watch. I've seen Israeli soldiers that are supposed to be protecting the settlers walk children, Palestinian children, to school through a graveyard at night so they don't get beat up on the way to school. And I find that very confusing. And I think that the American public needs to know what's happening there. We can't, it's a lawless place, and we can't bully these people around. And, you know, there's a million and a half people living in Gaza in an open-air prison. You wonder why they're angry.
Let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with writer and director of the new film, Miral, Rula Jibreel and Julian Schnabel. Rula Jibreel, polls indicate for the longest time that the majority of Israelis, up to 70%, want peace. And there has been some polling in the Palestinian Authority and even on the Hamas side that indicates an equal number on the Palestinian side. And if you poll the American people, they come out at about 60 to 70% in favor of peace. So given those numbers, what is driving the minority to maintain this unacceptable status quo?
Well, the minority, they keep the power. I mean, we listen, I don't know what I mean we, the Israeli government on one side, the Palestinian Authority, they are forced by these minorities to answer, by these minorities, to answer to the other side, to the other minority. For example, Bibi Netanyahu is held hostage by his minority in the government, and they are the ones that telling him, who are, you know, the Shas and other parties that are telling him, okay, if you will stop the settlements, you will not have any more government because you will not have numbers in the parliament. So in order to keep to stay in office, he has to please these people. And he's pleasing them on the cost of not making peace happen, on the cost of the majority of the Israeli people that want peace. From the other side, the Palestinian Authority has a very big problem with Hamas. Hamas is somebody that is a movement that was that became extremist. And you know what? If you study the history of Hamas, you understand that the fail of politics, the fact that the Oslo Agreement was killed, empowered extremist groups, especially Hamas, because they became as an alternative. Hamas came with a slogan in 2000 saying the Palestinian Authority for a long time didn't achieve anything from Israel through peace negotiation. Give us power, vote for us, and we will bring you back your rights by fighting. I think when you really kill a peace agreement, when you dehumanize a whole nation, when you push leaders like Abu Mazen, who is a real Democrat, and he was willing more than one time to sign any kind of agreement that guarantee a little bit of future democracy and freedom for his country. For years, he was waiting on the door, and the Israelis said, yes, finally, we have a good partner. Finally, Arafat is out of the, you know, he's out, he's dead, so now we will make peace because finally we find the right man. They never gave him anything. That really made Abu Mazen look like an idiot, like somebody that is not capable of bringing results. That's how Hamas actually became more powerful. And let's be honest, the corruption in the authority made it harder. But there's one thing that we forget to say. In 1993, when Rabin signed that agreement, he said a beautiful sentence. He said, I am making peace with the Palestinians because I know that we need to move forward and I need to see a future for my country. 3 years later, that same man said, I am the only one that made peace. I'm not talking about it. He was shot in the head after he left that stage. 3 bullets killed him. And from that moment, we heard seven Israeli prime ministers saying, we will talk about peace, we will talk about peace, but none of them made anything towards really concrete steps toward that process. And
I mean, how many settlements have been established since 1993, since the end of the Oslo Agreement?
Yeah, the Oslo Agreement, there was 50 settlements in 2000. Actually, now there are 200 settlements. That means that, and even, you know, if you consider not only that number of the settlement, the number of settlers, there used to be 200,000. Today there are 500,000 living in the West Bank, in the occupied territories. And these things, they don't help, actually. We forget that these things give the Palestinian one sign, that we will never accept any agreement, we will take more and more land, and you will always live as a guest.
Well, of course.
And a second citizen in your own country.
Sure.
If you think of the wall, you know, the border between Israel and Palestine is 380 kilometers, and the wall is 690. So you think why it has to be double? Simply because it goes inside and annex other land to Israel. And, you know, this is the attitude. This is what nobody talks about in this country.
Well, of course, also what people don't talk about is that there was a period after the Oslo Accords were signed when Israelis could buy furniture in Bethlehem, gamble in casinos in Jericho, and there was a display for all to see that peace is possible and it worked. That's the great tragedy that we've gone back in time. But let me ask Julian Schnabel about just going back to the film as opposed to the politics of the situation. It caught up on me emotionally. It just was a slow sort of build, and in the end, at the very end, the funeral, and of course that wonderful scene with the woman who runs the orphanage and the main character played by this beautiful Indian actress, talking about "You're My Hope," and then the funeral procession, in the end, it just absolutely overwhelmed me, and what the scenes where she becomes politically motivated, your character, Ruler
Miral, right?
Miral, when the house is demolished, it really does feel like a person. I mean, I think it conveyed the pain, an object, almost became a person.
Yes, I'm glad you felt that way. I think that the whole subject of rape is key to this movie. I mean, Nadia is raped because of the collapse of society. When that building is knocked down, it's the rape of the whole notion of land and of home. And when you see a Catherine Deneuve raped in her in Repulsion, and you see the Israelis watching the movie, they're becoming the victims of this suicide attack, this terrorist attack. At the same time, they are participating as voyeurs in this rape. So it's, I think sometimes there's so many histrionics and there's so many supposedly logical excuses or rebuttals or attacks and points of view that come from this, what I said, the actually just subliminally assimilating the Leon Uris narrative that people are looking for, and when they see the stock footage, or they say, why didn't you include this, or why didn't you include that? My job was to tell Rula's story, about Rula's memory, about Rula's antecedents, a psychogenetic portrait, all of the people that informed who she was. So by the time this girl shows up and sees this house getting knocked down, you understand who she is, what her response is, and why she would behave the way she does. And I think many film critics are looking for a more understandable or linear and logical narrative that would be the more standard or Hollywood way of telling a story, which I have no interest in doing. And I see this, even in our conversation as we sit talking on the radio, there's so much information. There's so many, there's so much blood running high in emotions and with positivistic kind of heels dug into the ground that it's impossible to see this story in an objective way. That's the inexhaustible, complete version of which everybody's asking for of this drama. But what you can do, or what I can do, is see it in a subjective way and talk about it in a magic way and deal with it in an expressionistic way and take my feeling for a human being, the feeling that Rula gave me because of the relationship and the love that she had with her father, the forgiveness that she had for her mother, the forgiveness that Hind had for her when she disobeyed Hind's rules, the contradiction in Hind saying no politics, but at the same time sending the girls to see the refugee camps so she's making them aware. And what I tried to do was to just show the different vivid moments in somebody's memory, in somebody's psyche, and bring the audience into a personal relationship so where they would empathize with this character. Then finally, the notion of, and the feeling is they do empathize with this character, they walk out of the movie theater and they care. And then as they say to themselves, am I supposed to care about this person? This person's supposed to be the enemy. But now they have a face, you realize that her father has a different take on life than Hani, and that Hind is different than Nadia and Fatima, and they're all Palestinians, but they're all different people. And sometimes people say, oh, the text is stiff, or there's people don't talk like that when they're kissing. Well, I'd like to dare anyone to go and live in that environment for a while, and you see what people talk about every day, and you cannot remove that omnipresent discussion from every personal moment. One line in the movie that I love is when Miral says to Lisa, "Are you in the army?" What other country does a girl meet a girl at a beach party and ask her if she's in the army? Because, I mean, so I think that it's what I'm very pleased with is that there is a controversy. People are waking up. I think Jewish people actually want to be part of the conversation with other Jewish people now because they want to know what this all about. Is there a problem with what we've been thinking? Do we need to consider this? I mean, 63 years, and we're no closer to making peace than we were a long time ago. So I think that the notion that we're able to show this movie at the United Nations and that people didn't want us to show this movie and that there's so much, I mean, something is breaking here. There is something that's opening up. And I mean,
well, let me ask Rula just in the last minute then to pick up on what Julian just said, because it seems to me, given the contagion of democracy spreading throughout the Middle East, a revolution young, led by young, tech-savvy, globally hooked up young Arabs, the Palestinian papers, Al Jazeera revealed recently, do show that the young Palestinians have every reason to be in the streets against their government, as the Egyptians do. Is there anything happening on the Israeli side as well? Do you think that there is a possibility that this film might be a catalyst for a generational shift in thinking?
I hope so. I have to tell you, watching the Arab world these days, these months actually, is what we've been waiting for our entire life. I saw it happening, working in Italy and working in Egypt, watching what was happening in Tunisia, in Syria these days. It was impossible for these nations to stay oppressed for so many years without standing up and raising their voice, saying, enough is enough. Now we want to be protagonists in our own country's destiny. We want to be part of the politics. We want to share, and we want democracy and freedom. This is what the Palestinians did in 87, and this is what they are doing these days. Nobody's covering this, but they went to the streets for a week, and they were saying three things. No Hamas, no Palestinian Authority, no corruption in the Palestinian Authority, and no military presence, no Israeli military presence in the West Bank. And I think until we don't listen to them, nothing will change. The thing that changed South Africa was two things. One, that the South African government, Leclerc, was forced to re-examine his politics by the international community. And second thing is reconciliation. What we are trying to do with this movie is open a debate, a dialogue, where we look at each other and we try both to examine what is going wrong and why our mistakes cannot hold us back from finding a solution. And until we don't admit that there's, you know, brutality, oppression, there's racism, and there's only one option was used on the, you know, in this country, which is only the military option and violence, until that moment comes, we will never find a solution. And yes, I feel that this movie is a small step, but that can open people's eyes about their own country, their own people. I mean, when Jewish people in New York see this movie and they have been supporting Israel their whole entire life, and they will go on supporting it, but now they might support it in a critical way, saying, you know what, instead of putting this money to build settlements, $3 billion every year, instead of putting it to build settlements, why don't you do something else? Why don't you really engage again in negotiation? Why we need to keep soldiers in the occupied territories? Maybe we can get to better results.
Well, I thank both of you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing, Rula Jibrail and Julian Schnabel. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Rula Jibrail, who wrote the novel Mural, and Julian Schnabel, who directed the new film based on the novel. The film is now out in theaters. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I'd love to know what you think. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.